Tuesday, November 18th, 1986, a group met at Hartzell's house to review plans for taping oral interviews to be used later on in doing a history of Stony Brook University. The group consisted of Sidney Gelber, former academic vice president, Tom Irvine, former dean of the College of Engineering, Francis Bunner, former chairman of the Department of Chemistry, and Clifford Swartz of the Physics Department, former editor of the Physics Teacher.
The whole system getting its way, getting into the papers and everything. That was quite remarkable. That was the first of its kind.
If the real history,
and we weren't shot.
If the real history gets accurately written, nobody will believe it.
I know. That's when they first gathered together a committee, when Marbury called some of us together about getting about a year ago or something, and just exactly what Francis said, I said, "Oh, you want to write a history?" I said, "If you're going to write a history, and if you really get down the facts as they occurred," I said, "No one's going to believe it. You know, so you're going to have a problem of credibility."
That's really right.
There's a lot of stuff in the old newspapers.
Oh yeah.
Some of it was accurate. Some of it was inaccurate.
But there was a lot of stuff.
Yeah, in the Times and Newsday.
Newsday. There was that fellow Carr who later on got a lot of fancy plaudits to him. I really was furious.
What was his name? Marty?
No, Martin? Robert Carroll.
Oh, something. Robert Carroll.
And he came, everything was hitting the fan.
Wasn't Buskin there?
Not in those days. He came later. Buskin may have been the education, but he didn't get involved in something.
This guy had a systematic bias.
Oh, yes.
It was incredible.
And I was furious.
It was as though he was really out to destroy the college.
There's no question. I felt that. So I said to him once that I thought that he was doing us a disservice. So he said, "Well, look, I'm willing to write a better story, but I need background. No one's giving me this." I said, "Well, all right, if you get background." Well, for about 3.5 years after that, everyone's threatened to sue me. He put everything in the newspapers. And I named names and everything. I called a friend of mine who was a lawyer, just in case. I mean, that was really dirty pool, and he put it in such a context as though this was sour grapes type of thing. Yes.
Someone that was helpful to us was Fred Eckinger.
Oh, no question.
Yeah, Eckinger was good.
There was a crucial moment in which I said something to him, and he said, do you mind if I attribute you directly? I know that's a very important point. And I thought about it, and I said, why not?
When was this?
Well, it was 1960.
60, yeah.
John Lee was fired. I can almost pinpoint it because I was in South America when the whole thing blew up.
Yeah.
I was sitting in my office one morning and the phone rang, and it was Eckinger. And he said, "You'd like to make a statement about the fact that your president was fired." I said, "What?" I said, "First I heard of it." He was fired by the trustees, and the Times got a hold of it somehow.
Yeah, well, I drove up with him.
It was on the front page of the Times.
Yeah. Well, I drove up with him to Albany. It was a day or two before.
With Eckinger?
No, with John Lee.
Remember the month?
October.
And he, we went up, and he went, I waited for him outside, and they had called him in, Hamilton. And someone from the board, I guess it was the, who was that time secretary of the board, this old political from Buffalo.
Murray.
Yeah. And they had a letter all set for him to sign. And he looked and says, "Absolutely not." He said, "If you want me out, you'll fire me." And he said, "That's exactly what'll happen. And then, you know, your career will be damaged and whatnot." And that's when he came back that night. The meeting was called, if you recall, in his house, what to do, what next step. And that was decided to go for an open letter to Rockefeller. And he had the press conference in the Biltmore.
Oh, yeah, I remember press conference in Biltmore. I had the flu. Yeah.
And at that press conference, by that time, the media was there, television, the newspapers, and the letter, the public letter to the governor had gone out. Because that morning, as sure as the anything, he was fired. You know? And, as a matter of fact, weren't they sealing the files? That at
yes.
a certain hour, he couldn't
That's
get
right.
the files.
They were sealing the files.
Yeah.
Yeah, somebody called me up and said, put your files in the car.
That's right. Take them away.
I said, hell with it.
That's right.
Yeah, I had a feeling of terrorism.
Yeah.
Yeah,
yeah,
we did.
Yeah, who was
That's
the
strange.
Who was the business manager then, remember? Because he was the guy who was asked to seal all the files.
Yeah.
A thin fellow.
Thin, darkish
I think
fellow.
He was still business manager when you came.
When I came.
Yeah.
Conway?
No.
Cooper.
Yeah.
Right.
Charlie Cooper.
That's
Charlie
it.
Cooper.
Good
right.
man.
He yeah, was, he very was, good
yeah.
man. As a matter of fact, he was working later.
Back up in Albany.
Where he went up to Albany, yeah.
Right. I think he
was
wanted to get a degree so that he could hold up his
He was replaced by Maurice Coster.
Right.
Yes.
Whom they called Pink Socks.
But you see, if all you have to do is squeeze us, and you'll be before long, you'll find out.
It'll all come out.
That's right. One drink will help.
I remember.
Will come out.
I remember a meeting in the Coe Cottage, which was John Lee's house.
That's
where
right.
Carl got it. When people were called to come, and Harry Kalish was called, and he came and rang the doorbell and asked what was going on, and when they told him, he turned around and walked away.
I remember that. I was to remind him some years later of that.
He didn't want to get involved?
No.
Did you reminded Harry of that?
Yeah.
What did he say?
Well, he said he was very, very confused and upset at the time. He didn't know what was happening. And, no, as a matter of fact, there were a few. Some really came out as really strong as here. Arnie Feingold, for one.
He was a fighter.
He really was. And
what did he?
He
well,
was
Arnie.
He was the dean of the graduate school.
Yeah, and he quit.
Did you know? You know that
Publicly.
Arnie was our first dean of
That's
the graduate
right.
school.
Somebody told me that.
Yeah, he was the
I
first dean.
Maybe you did.
Yeah, he was first dean. And
Dave Fox after that.
Well, he was chairman of the graduate
no.
committee.
I think wasn't Ed? Wasn't not Ed? But
What's
Jordan.
This fell from England.
Oh, from England.
Wasn't
Jordan.
He before Dave Fox?
Well, I didn't make any. When I came, there was no dean of the graduate school.
No, that
we
was
had the
that's
land.
Right.
That's because Arnie.
That's right.
Arnie what? Resigned in anger.
In anger and protest.
He terrified. He got. He made Hamilton very upset.
That was that publicly at a.
Yes,
a
faculty,
meeting. Yeah,
he got
I
up
remember.
And quit.
Yeah.
Well, what happened earlier is that I was closeted earlier with Porter. And Porter was very apologetic that events happened to take a certain turn, and he tried to plead that he was a new guy working in the system. He had just been made provost of the system, and he really didn't know what was happening. However, he was acting on Hamilton's orders, who had come down with him for that famous meeting. And
when was that meeting? Do you remember?
That famous faculty meeting was. It happened just
it must have
right
been
after.
Must
right
have
after
been about
he was
the first,
fired.
About the 1st of November.
It was at the
I
end of
guess.
October, early November.
I would guess.
Yeah.
About then.
This is 60?
60.
1960, yeah. All happened.
John Lee became president in about January 1960, and he was
right.
fired about the middle of October.
That's right.
It all happened that fast.
That's right.
Why was he fired?
Well,
Sydney will give you the.
I can tell you.
I think the thing just got to be such a mess.
No. Well, there were a couple of things. I mean, there was Hamilton. First of all, was basically a weak man, and he couldn't make his own judgments as to what was going on. Secondly,
how long had he been president?
Hamilton became
maybe 2 years.
Yeah, about 2 years. He was president there. And basically, what happened is when the Hill report got written. John Lee took that to be the mandate for the university.
Took it and ran with it.
You know, and decided that was it. He went and first tried, that was one dimension. There was another counterpoint thing going, and that was what was happening on campus with when Olson had become dean. He brought in Alan Austell to be dean of students. And there was a constant undercurrent of people who did not want a university, per se. I mean, they wanted basically a college, and they wanted, as a matter of fact, there was one plan John Lee floated, if you recall, one time, to leave some people there in a four-year college setup and move the rest to university. That was, and he...
In Stony Brook.
Yeah, and he called them into the office.
Keep a branch going in those people.
And having, and some people from the old group said they would prefer to stay there, you know. And he thought that would be a way to solve things. But Albany said, no way. He said, there was going to be one institution, that was it. But Lee got very frustrated because he was getting no effective response as to how they were going to implement. He wanted to know how he was going to implement this thing. And so you remember, you and I came in with a budget, the first budget, and Lee said in his flamboyant way, what? You're only asking for so much? You got to go back and redo all your stuff. I mean, we're sitting up all night. And he, in other words, he wanted to challenge them and say, okay, you want a university, we got to have the support immediately apparent. And they weren't about to do it for many reasons. The system, in spite of the Heald report, I think the inertia that had built up, for one. Secondly, the upstate people were wanted to be in the ascendancy, or the non-New York, let's speak. Buffalo was not in the system yet. And Lee got very impatient. Lee was an impatient guy, basically, somewhat flamboyant and impatient. And he called down...
And not very political. I mean,
no, unbelievable. I thought, you know, Aristotle's a statement that the human animal is a political one. And I said there was always one exception, John F. Lynn, to that. No, Francis is right. I mean, he, you know, we had lots of discussion with him. Don't, you know, attack Austell publicly, or when you get something from Austell, get it in writing, we said to him. Don't take a phone call, act on, because they said to him at one meeting, get rid of Austell. So he said, great, I'm going to get rid of him. We said, wait, get it in writing, you know, at least. Which he didn't, you know, and he called him in and said, you know, we don't want you.
Yeah, and that triggered
that. That triggered the students and everything. But the interesting thing is he called in Jim Allen. That's what got their backs up.
Yeah. Yes, they, I remember when Allen came to the campus.
Exactly. They were furious because when he went up and they had that letter for him to sign, they reminded him. They said, you know, made an end run play here. You brought Allen. I mean, they're the public enemy of SUNY, you know. And Lee, you know, his view was, how can he be an enemy? He's ready to support us on this stuff, which was a very interesting switch. And it was later, after Lee was fired, that when Allen called him and he went to his home in Albany, he came to the living room, there was Rockefeller. That was the time Rockefeller got him the job in Washington and apologized for what happened. And said to him that he was now going to see to it that the state university was going to be a major institution. The system as a whole is Stony Brook to pick him. So Lee, I think, you know, put his body on the line. He was the first.
I have never had any doubt that if without that whole episode and without John Lee's bulldozing apolitical tactics, we never would have made it.
No, you're absolutely right.
Not have become this institution.
And that's an interesting case in point. I mean, you know, here we say, well, he wasn't very political, but yet you're absolutely right. Were he very political, it would have been drawn out.
We would never have made it.
Never. They would have, you know, really snuffed everyone out.
He made a drama.
That's right.
So he created a situation in which Fred Hechinger could call up and ask crucial questions and get them in the newspaper, and then and they had to be answered in a certain way, as Hamilton came down and answered
Hamilton
them.
Hamilton was sketch at this.
I called up Commissioner Allen and asked if I could see him, and he immediately said yes. And Arnie Feingold and I went up and had a long interview with Allen, and I'm sure that he was gathering information. All of these things made a big difference in the future of the institution.
And later, Lee was to tell me that, of course, Allen told him when he saw him something that Rockefeller got all of his information was happening from Allen directly. And Allen was already very well disposed to what we were trying to do.
Yeah,
and,
I was very impressed with him.
He was very impressed. I'll never forget, I think... it was Jack Ludwig who used the analog of the Mets. They were just forming a team, the baseball team, the Mets, and said, you know, we don't want to be like those Mets, you know, we want to really be champs, and we can't wait. I remember that. But...
I don't know whether I should interrupt this or not. This sounds awfully good.
It would have been good if you were taping it all.
It is.
You are taping it? Oh.
But I think this is what we're just saying. I think it's really interesting because nobody, it's not very widely known at all. No. I mean, you say, who was the first president of Stony Brook?
Well, they don't know.
Nobody knows the name of John F. Lee.
No.
Right. And the fact of his being here and that whole episode having taken place, I mean, all of us agree that that was absolutely crucial.
No question.
The institution would never have become what it is without that having...
No, it would either have been closed now, or they would have turned to just a little college there in Oyster Bay, or if they brought it out here, it would have been a... as some of the people thought, it'd be a nice little, you know, quiet college.
What Mr. Melville would.
Yeah, exactly. And the net result, I think, is it forced the issue to the surface, and they had to deal with it. It became too public, too quickly. I mean, the governor had to deal with it. This is an open-ended governor. The legislature eventually had to deal with it. And don't forget, the legislature supported the Hill Commission and its report. So they couldn't suddenly say, we don't know what they're talking about. So you had a new alignment of political forces. And of course, Rockefeller decided to make this one of his important...
Right.
Yeah, that was one of his great contributions.
You see, Carl, what I'm referring to about the assistance of Fred Hechinger during this whole period when John Lee is driving toward development of a major university and trying to get the resources to do it, trying to get the commitment from Albany to do it. The schism that's taking place on campus is those of us that are busy preparing for PhD programs and those that are busy preparing for small college operations. And this crucial phone call from Fred Hechinger to me, within that conversation, I made this point. This is after John Lee was fired. Mm-hmm. And he had a whole background piece around Christmas time.
That was a very important piece.
And
that
he asked, and one of the points I made was, we have to know whether we have this commitment or not, because if we're going to be a doctoral granting campus, we've got to get started right away. That means we have to start recruiting graduate students now. We have to get the word out now. There is no possibility of delay. And that's what he asked if he could attribute to me, and he did.
Mm-hmm.
And the following week, Thomas Hamilton came down to Oyster Bay with an approval of the chemistry PhD program.
Is that right?
Yeah. Well, I told that story at our 25th or 26th anniversary a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Francis was... actually, it was Leek. Hamilton came into this room. He had gotten a phone call. He had read this piece. The governor apparently had read the Hechinger piece. Had called Hamilton and said, you said that, you know, everything will become... What the heck's going on? Because it was already after the immediate crisis. And he came into the room, and he said, and a number of us were seated around, he said, well, what, heaven's sake, do you people want? What assurance do you want we're going to build? You know we're going to have a university. And everyone said, well, we really don't believe it. And he said, oh, what do I have to do to convince you? And I think you're the one who said, well, give authorization for PhD programs. He said, all right, what program? And you said, chemistry. He said, you have it. The reason I cited this is that many years later, when the State Ed Department decided to review all PhD programs, that they did a thorough inventory. And Dan Murray, who was in charge of all graduate programs for SUNY Central, called me one day very nervous. And he said, I think Stony Brook may have problems. I said, what do you mean? He said, they've been given PhDs in chemistry and physics for many years, but we have nothing in the files. So I said, well, we got it from the horse's mouth. So I said, that's the best way. And I had to tell him the whole story. He laughed. And of course, they found some notation from Hamilton that he had
approved.
That's right. Personally. What a system.
Was Hamilton actually fired by Rockefeller?
Yeah. Well, I don't know whether he resigned or was fired. I don't know the details, but...
He certainly was pushed out.
Yeah. Right.
It wasn't on the front pages of the Times the way John Lee's fired.
No. No, it was quietly done. He went to Hawaii.
Yeah.
But I got here in September 62, and a week after I'd been here, Hamilton, who had appointed me, as far as I know, had said that he was leaving.
Yeah.
When the trustees fired John Lee, they designated Hamilton himself to be the acting president of
the... And Harry Porter to be acting head of arts and sciences.
Did they do that?
Yes, he had that time. Some years later, but then later on, he was to be, that was the way Hamilton got Porter to be here on campus. Hamilton couldn't be here, so Harry Porter, in effect, had that title, acting for Hamilton, really, in that capacity.
Yeah.
And then, as Harry Porter was to say later, you know, he paid for that by getting ulcers coming down before you came on the scene. And Porter, you see, their intelligence was screwed up. It was all messed up. They were receiving information about the campus from Al Nostal, from some of these people, and they were convinced that the faculty, as well as the students and some of the staff, were not an anti-Lee, but were opposed to all this noise about what type of institution we wanted. And that's why they felt very convinced that they could come down, fire Lee, and get support of the faculty. They were in a state of shock. Porter, later that night, took me and said,
"What night?"
The night when they had the big faculty meeting and all the votes went exactly opposite to what they anticipated, Hamilton and Porter, if you recall. And there were a series of resolutions. Porter later spoke to me and said, "I'm shocked. We didn't think this would happen. This is very embarrassing." So I said to him, "You're not going to ask me for advice, not that you kicked me out." I said, I could have told you that. I said, "We were telling you this for some time. You remember those meetings we went up? And Lee was saying this message, you know, the fact that he was essentially moving in one direction and there were a few people who were not." They didn't believe it. And that's what started causing them great grief, because they realized now they didn't have the faculty behind them. And they had to go back to the trustees. They had to go back to Allen, who was getting information, I guess, for the governor. Jim Allen was commissioner of education.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that was an interesting turn of events, because here was a commissioner who normally the State Ed Department wasn't so friendly with the public institutions.
Was not pro-SUNY.
No.
No.
And he was prepared to support this whole thing. As a matter of fact, Lee sold him a bill of goods when he visited us that time, to bring some of the members of the Board of Regents to some of the large state universities. And I remember lists were being made up. Where would they go? Minnesota, Michigan, I forget now. But there was discussion of that.
I said that there has been a conflict in point of view. And I ran into one side of it up there, and we had the other. One point of view was that of the Heal Report, that this new institution was going to be developed to stand with the finest in the country.
Second to none.
And
stand with the finest.
The report. I just read the report again. The other point of view was not national. It was the state, and it was relativistic in terms of equality with Albany and Binghamton and Buffalo, and they were not about to see Stony Brook become go much farther ahead than these other three institutions.
Well, actually, the Hill Report recommended only two.
I know it. That's Buffalo and.
But the Hill Report didn't recommend that Stony Brook be better than Buffalo. I mean,
No.
Recommended development at the two ends of the state.
That's true,
but the decision to bring in Albany and Binghamton was a wholly political, geopolitical decision.
As but well as the whole development of four-year colleges.
It was national in its view of the future of both Stony Brook and Buffalo.
That's right.
But it mentioned Stony Brook specifically.
Because we were de novo. I mean, we were. That was part of the problem. What do you do with an institution that's just building? Where should it go? Other institutions, they already have their missions and already have their mandates pretty well worked out.
I think the Heald Commission recognized this is that it was the best chance.
Yeah, exactly. And that's why I think Rockefeller took this as a wonderful opportunity. Because he had something new to develop.
Who appointed the Heald Commission?
I think it was a legislative committee. As a matter of fact, there's a little history.
Wasn't it Carlson? Who was the chancellor?
Was Carlson chancellor then?
President, really?
President.
Carlson. Yeah.
Carlson, yeah. Well, before him was Alvin Urich.
Harvard or?
1950. Yeah. Write it, because I have a book, which is a fascinating set of documents. Conference was held, Tom Dewey. And I just by accident, I ran to this. They took the entire proceedings of this conference, put them in a book, under the aegis of State University. Alvin Urich was head of the system, and the question that Dewey posed to Urich was, should we go back to the state legislature? See, what they were going after the war, they went back every year for enabling legislation. They did not set up legally an entity called state. Each year they went to have money appropriated for what they called were education opportunities under the banner of the state for vets returning. Dewey asked Urich, okay, should we go back again for another year, or should we instead ask for development of a state system? Higher education. I think there were some legislators who supported whatever. So Urich called a conference, and he had some of the most eminent educators in this country called there. He had the Chancellor of Chicago, the President of Harvard. He had the Piercy. President of Teachers. No, that was Koenig. And the interesting thing is that the general tenor of this meeting, because a lot of the people drawn were from the private sector, and a lot of them were saying, in effect, well, you did your job. You, the veterans came, you did what you had to do, fine. If you want to keep a public system, maybe you want to have technical colleges or two, because we have fine universities in the Northeast, and you have these fine private universities of Rochester and Columbia, and, you know, the big one. And if anything, it was, what's his name from Chicago?
Hutchins.
Who, in the middle of this whole thing, he used the metaphor of the medieval university, you know. And it's so far cry from as almost looking down his nose at the public institutions and saying, well, you can't really be serious, you know, in these places. they're noisy and cumbersome type things. They're not dedicated to true learning. And also recommend that we forget about any development hierarchy. We're in the Northeast, we're lucky, we're not like these primitive states out in the West. You see that have to happen. Tom Dewey at the end gave a kind of farewell talk, thanked everybody, and then sort of reminded them that he was a product of public higher education, that he had come out of University of Michigan and lost, and in effect saying, well, you know, he got pretty good education, and it stood him quite well. So then he said, look, I'm looking at this not as an edge, as a politician. And I look at the demographics. And the problems you had earlier are nothing compared to what you're going to face now. And I, for one, have to be responsible to the citizens of this state. And I cannot see that we can terminate. Exactly. If anything, I think we have to go forward with the system. So Tom Dewey already perceived that, 1950. But there was a lot of bitter infighting. I don't know the full politics
there. On the date, the state university legislation was 48.
48, yeah.
That got them, but the question was, there was a lot of debate, and I don't know where it was started, the legislature or where, should they continue?
When was your meeting, this meeting that you're describing?
These meetings were in New York City on 1950, in May, I think, of 1950.
Because you already had,
yeah.
You already had the Young Commission, which on the need for a state university appointed by Dewey, and the report of that commission was 47 or early 48.
Which led to the Charter of SUNY.
It led to the Charter of SUNY.
But why, there was some, I say, political problems that led him to ask Urich to run this huge conference, because Urich
was 50.
I should double check the date.
Would you?
Yeah,
please
double check the date.
This is
well, you know, I just thought too, what was his name? The fellow who came into the state of New York, wrote a report before the
hearing.
From Minnesota, right?
Yes.
What's the name?
Blaney. He became president of Texas, University of Texas.
Wasn't he dean? Who was the one who was dean of the graduate school from Minnesota?
Oh, yeah, he came.
And they apparently drove him out of the state because he He used the Minnesota model. There should be a single
That's the report that I remember. What was that guy's name?
What was it? Blagan.
The Blagan.
That was the Blagan report. And they practically drove him out of the state because he spoke of a single. It's like Minnesota.
Was that what you were thinking of? Or was there another one by Blaney?
I think it was another one by Blaney, and Blaney came up with the reverse and with
multiple campuses.
Made about four institutions. I think that's what, I'm confused, but I know that that decision had to be made before the state university.
But there was a lot of dragging of the feet. You see, that even though they mandated things, the question was, should they go ahead?
Well, that's what the whole issue in
Of course,
the Hill Commission made a report. We were there taking it seriously.
That's right.
But they were not taking it seriously.